It's like anything in startups. Like there is no preparation. It's existential. The alternative is death. So you'll do anything.
Hey everyone. Thanks for tuning in to Shopify Masters. I'm your host, Shuang Esther Shan, and this is your companion for starting and scaling a business. Will Nitza founded IQ Bar when he couldn't find a product that nourished his body and his brain. So he transformed a kitchen experiment into a nutritional powerhouse with a simple mission: make a superior snack bar that's powered by plant proteins, fuels you to win the day, and not crash after a surge in energy. In just 7 years, IQ Bar has exploded to over $60 million in sales, with 50 million protein bars flying off the shelves in 2024 alone. We'll cover how you can go from a burnt-out corporate employee to a fulfilled founder in this episode. Welcome to the show, Will.
Thanks for having me.
So great to have you here. I would love to start from the beginning because you had a corporate job, very stable, but you wanted to experiment in the kitchen and create this food item. What made you want to do this giant pivot?
Yeah. Well, I wasn't always entrepreneurial, but I was always obsessive as a kid. I was obsessed with chess and then soccer and for a bit cross country. And I would say that obsession turned to entrepreneurship probably, I don't know, sophomore or junior year in college as I was thinking about what I want to do with my life. But I didn't really know what I was going to create or how I was going to become my own boss. And I became fascinated concurrently with psychology and neuroscience. And so I got to senior year and I was like, all right, I want to do something great. I want to build something. But I'm also really interested in the brain, and I couldn't like square that circle in terms of starting something, and I couldn't even really figure out how to, you know, what job that would map to. And so I just sort of ran out of time and took a job at a software company selling and marketing ops and supply chain software to predominantly oil and gas companies, but also utility companies. And I'm so glad that I got that job and took that job. I was not at all passionate about oil and gas, and I was not really passionate about software either. But I learned, first of all, I learned all the basic skills of Excel, PowerPoint, how do you run a meeting, what's it like to have a boss, what's it like to have a hard boss, and just like what corporate America is all about. And just like a lot of people, I was dreading Mondays. And but again, I'm so glad that happened because I have that nice juxtaposition to entrepreneurship. But that was like the bedrock of why I wanted to, you know, do my own thing. And concurrent to me having that job, I got really into nutrition for personal reasons. I felt kind of like crap every day. I had a terrible diet. And so I adopted a paleo diet, cut out carbs mostly, and felt way better. And I was always interested in the intersection of cognition and nutrition. So not so much like losing weight or building muscle, but how do the things I put in my body affect my brain, to dovetail with my earlier collegiate interest in brain function. All those things kind of came together. It was like, wasn't passionate about my job, didn't want to do that for 40 years, got really into nutrition, and then I had that prior interest in the brain, and so I eventually landed on, I'm going to start a brain food company. And then, of course, I had no friggin' clue how to make things, sell things, manufacture things. I didn't even know how to set up a company, any of it. So, but that was the impetus originally.
Yeah. I love hearing kind of the components that led to your decision. And you also found yourself in the space of bars. And I feel like at that time, there was already a lot of competition. The market was pretty saturated. But to your point, there weren't an offering that was looking after cognition. So how did you begin doing more research, recipe testing, and kind of formulating in your own kitchen?
Yeah, I mean, and I'm also glad that I was an outsider to the space. I don't know anyone who's ever made a food company or even is an entrepreneur, really, in my family. And so I just started from like first principles. So I opened an Excel spreadsheet and I went to Whole Foods. I bought a bunch of bars. I looked at the back. I said, okay, this is what's in all of these bars. That's kind of the fun thing about food and bev, is they literally tell you what's in the product, so you can categorize all that. And then I said, what are all the compounds that are good for your brain or have been shown to be good for your brain in, you know, research? So omega-3s, vitamin E, magnesium, et cetera, et cetera. And then sub-bullet of that, what are the whole food ingredients that are richest in those things? You know, almonds are rich in vitamin E and cocoa is rich in flavonoids and so on and so forth. And then was just so like, here's what's on the market and here's how people get bars made and this is how they get it to stick together and taste good and all that. And then here's all the things I need to combine to make a bar. And I literally just like brute iterated on that and had tons of misadventures there. So like I wanted to originally include curcumin, for example, which is an extract of turmeric, which is really good for your brain, but it turns the bar orange. It stains your fingers orange. It tastes terrible. So like, okay, cross that off the list. I wanted to include resveratrol powder, which is the component of grapes that's good for your brain. That's why some people say, you know, drinking red wine is actually not all that unhealthy, which is kind of a myth, but I couldn't do that because the bar was going to cost $10. So you quickly get into these sort of commercial realities that you have to bump up against. And you're like, wait a second, the market maybe doesn't even want that, even though it's good for them, and doesn't want to pay for that. And so that's what makes entrepreneurship so nuanced, is like it's not even always about the best product. It's about the right product that fits into the keyhole of the commercial opportunity. But more broadly, did people want brain bars? Like, I didn't know, and there was no data on that. So there was a huge leap of faith, which, and I'm sure we can get into the Kickstarter, but that was the point of the Kickstarter, was I'm going to do this thing, I'm going to do this crowdfunding campaign, and that'll tell me if the market wants brain food. And then, you know, I'll iterate from there.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like even before reaching Kickstarter, you were already thinking about the end consumer and making this idea of the bar actually accessible to them. So yeah, talk to us about validating your idea with Kickstarter, and then in the background, also scaling from testing on your own to looking for production partners and co-packing facilities.
Yeah, so you have to do the second part first, or I did the second part first, which is, okay, I need to find someone to make this thing. And some people will make it themselves in a commissary kitchen, or you can actually technically make it in your home if you want to and you get the right permits. But, you know, I was not interested in either of those things. I wanted to go big, do this emphatic test, and either it really works or it really doesn't. And so I went straight to contract manufacturers, which are, you know, they have a bar line. It's literally a line. And at the front of it, you mix your inputs and then you, what's called slab them. It's basically like roll out the dough, and then it slices the dough, and then guillotines into bars, and then they go into what's called a flow wrapper and it gets wrapped. And so I went straight there and I said, hey, I'm a guy with an idea. I think it's a good idea. Here's why you should work with me. What's your minimum order quantity? And a lot of people said no. And then one guy said, okay, it's 20,000 bars or something. So then I was like, okay, that's what I have to create, 20,000 bars worth of demand with a Kickstarter. And it's kind of solving that chicken or egg problem. And so I had like a target. So then we did the Kickstarter, and I researched how do you run a good Kickstarter. And there's a zillion blog posts, and that was not at all how we actually successfully ran the Kickstarter. Quite frankly, we engaged in some, what I would say, are like gray hat tactics. Basically, we found, this is kind of a crazy story. I went to Harvard undergrad. I went to the Harvard Library because I still lived in Boston at the time. And there are these things called Red Books. And in the Red Books, they have alumni details. So it would say, Will Nitza lives in Boston, married, has two dogs, and here's his email address. And then it would go like, Nancy Johnson and blah, 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 blah. Here's Nancy's email address. And so I literally flipped through page by page by page by page. I would spend nights doing this for weeks on end, taking photos of every page. And then I ran it through software that extracted email addresses. And now I had,
oh my gosh,
10,000 email addresses. And of all people who went to Harvard from great, you know, classes like, you know, 2000 to call it 2014. And then I got this login to Harvard Business School from my boss who used to go there, and I was able to extract like 80,000 email addresses from that. Right. Again, you would never find this on any blog post or anything like that.
This is some crazy hacking here. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And I got a MailChimp account at the time. And the reply to email address was my Harvard email address, my Harvard alumni email address, right? Because if you get a bunch of emails marked as spam, it hurts your domain score. And it's your, like, you know, company domain, it'll hurt your domain score. But if it's my Harvard alumni email address, I don't, you know, whatever, right? So I then emailed everyone, just like blasted them, right? And I was like, hey, my name's Will. I was class of 2014. I have this idea. It would mean the world if you check out my campaign, my Kickstarter campaign. And a zillion people wrote back. They're like, how'd you find my email address? Like, never email me again. A ton of people marked me as spam. But then, like, an outpouring of people were like, this is awesome. This takes hustle. I just bought two boxes or whatever. And then some people connected me with other people in the food business because, again, there's just such a high volume of people you're hitting up that just luck starts falling out of the sky for you. And I think we did like $30,000 of orders just from those emails. And then the way Kickstarter works is it's a totally momentum-based. So if, you know, you have a really good first day, you're on the homepage of your sector, food and bev, and then you need to stay there, you need to keep momentum going. So if your volume of orders drops off, you'll fall off the front page. You want to stay on the front page because roughly half of all of our orders came organically. Someone who we didn't know or talk to, they just went to Kickstarter, they went to the page, they saw us, and they bought. And so it was key that we stayed on that front page, and we did. And so ultimately we did like 75 grand in orders, and half of that was totally organic, but we kept that momentum going mostly through these emails.
Yeah. Well, it sounded like such a brilliant idea, but it also required a lot of like manual labor from you to extract all these emails. Like, was it, I mean, at least you heard the tip that you need a lot of eyes on the campaign. So then you kind of had this idea to look at alumni directory in a sense.
There's many ways to get eyeballs, right? That the issue I had was I had no money. So,
Gotcha. Yeah.
You know, a lot of people would be like, oh, go buy Facebook ads or whatever. And you could, but think about that. It's hard enough to acquire customers at a reasonable price as a store that can fulfill an order you place today, tomorrow. Now imagine the proposition of, oh, hey, here's this thing. It's a prototype. I probably won't ship it for 6 months. And like, I might not even ship it at all. Who's going to convert on that Facebook ad? Like, no one. So, and not to mention, it costs money. And there's like 10 other examples, right? And you could go PR, but no one at that time wanted to cover Kickstarter campaigns. And no press outlet wanted to cover them because there are a couple high-profile sort of more or less scams. And so the press had soured on it. And so it's like, I have no money. No one wants to cover this. It's not like a groundbreaking product. It's like kind of a cool product, but it's not, you know, we're not inventing, you know, shoes that help you hover off the ground or something. Like, it's a protein bar. So you just have to get crafty.
Yeah. Well, you unlock Kickstarter. You can now do the minimum quantity order that the production partner requires. But I feel like this also opens the door of like facing new issues with production and understanding the supply chain. So yeah, talk to us about some of those early learnings in there.
Yeah. I mean, like, you start learning things immediately because we had 2,000 and something or other orders and we're like, oh crap, like how do we fulfill these? And we had planned around it. We had a 3PL that lined up that was going to do it, but still stuff just went wrong and we didn't really have a good customer service infrastructure set up. And so, you know, orders were delayed. And by the way, we didn't fulfill when we said we were like a month late to that. And so it was just chaos. And also we were producing the product for the first time ever. And so the product didn't turn out exactly as I wanted it to. It was good, but there were a couple like product flaws. And so it was just like drinking from a fire hose on everything. You know, manufacturing, what are the 10 things that went wrong? Got it. there's my list to fix for next time. Fulfillment, what are the 10 things that went wrong? There's my list for that. Customer service, there's my list for that. And it's just like, okay, I have like a novella of mistakes, and let's just like make fewer of those in all aspects when we produce a second time around. But yeah, and then like we got a website up, and so all the overflow traffic from Kickstarter went to our website, because rather than like back this project, it was go to company's website or whatever the call to action became. And then we got repeat purchases from people who got the Kickstarter orders and liked them. And so we were off to the races at that point.
Cut to the years during COVID, it also challenged you to rethink how your supply chain works, and it made you pivot to actually like house and invest in your own supplies for the raw materials. How has that shift been?
Yeah, I mean, that was such a massive learning. So I guess just at a high level, it used to be in consumer goods that everyone would say, you want to become a sales and marketing company. You don't want to become an operations company or a supply chain company or a manufacturing company. You want to outsource all that, and you want to be a sales marketing company, because let's assume you want to get to an exit. And it used to be the case that really you were exiting on off your top line. How much net revenue am I generating? And then some multiplier on that, and that's how much my company's worth. That was the way it was for many years there, call it between 2015 and 2022. And then in 2022, that completely inverted. And so investors all the way up to acquirers said, actually, forget that. It's actually now all about net profitability. And it's hard to overstate just how meteoric of a change that is. The entire engineering of most CPG brands' modus operandi is, it has to like change overnight, and like violently change overnight. Luckily, we had always obsessed over operations such that we were ready for that. But even being ready for it and obsessing over it, your supply chain and cost of goods in manufacturing agreements and all that is really ugly to start in consumer goods, because volume, we are in a volume game. We just are in bars, but also in drinks, but also in cookies, but also in crackers. Like consumer good food and bev is a volume game. And so your unit economics are going to be bad. They just are, until you get to call it 20, 30 million units a year. And then they get really good. And then they get really, really, really good once you're at like 100 million units a year. And so when COVID hit, we were still in that first leg of the journey. So it was not only bad, it was like catastrophically and potentially existentially bad, because not only were our unit economics not great still, and we were moving probably 10 million units a year or something like that, but we literally couldn't make product because we couldn't get certain inputs. We couldn't get cardboard. Like, of course you can find cardboard always, right? No, turns out you can't, because there's this global pandemic. Of course we could get wrappers. Well, no, actually your wrappers are stuck in a rail yard in Nashville. And yeah, now you have 3 million wrappers that you literally can't get out of that rail yard. You know, crazy stuff happens like that. And so at that point, we shifted from a model, which is known as turnkey, which basically means your contract manufacturer buys all the inputs, they make the finished good, and then they just send you a bill for finished good times price of finished good. And that's great in many ways, right? It's administratively not burdensome on you, the brand. It's good for cash flow because you didn't have to outlay all the cash to get all those inputs. You know, it's just like quite seamless. The downside is when you literally can't get certain inputs, they're not going to go the extra mile to figure out how to actually make product. They're just going to say, well, supplier XYZ said they can't do it. Sorry, we can't make your product. That's like downside one. And downside two is gross margin. So when the manufacturer's incentives are perverse, believe it or not, in a turnkey model, because typically they are marking up or taking a percentage of the total cost as what's called a materials management fee. So that could be something like 2.5% or 3%.
you know, having control over your supplies and your raw goods also helped with the margins that you were playing with as well, instead of the turnkey model that you worked with.
So turnkey doesn't really work when you're in an environment where you literally can't find inputs, because the person at your co-packer who's managing your supply chain just isn't going to go the extra mile when supplier XYZ tells them, sorry, we don't have any supply. And so that leads to cardinal sin number one of running out of product, going out of stock. Like, that is the death knell of any CPG brand. But also more broadly, in a turnkey model, your gross margin is somewhere between 3 and 5% lower than if you are actually sourcing all of your inputs, because the co-packer in that turnkey model is perversely incented to actually have you pay a little bit more on inputs, because they mark up the inputs and they charge what's called a material management fee. So A, you can't make product, and B, your gross margin is meaningfully worse. And actually C, your gross margin won't improve. There's no positive evolution of gross margin expansion, because in a turnkey model, the co-packer is not going to go back to each one of your suppliers and negotiate to reduce prices as your volume goes up.
Yeah. Well, listening to that, of course, there is the benefit of like having better margins, more control of when your raw goods and your supplies would arrive at the different facilities. But now you've essentially made your job a lot harder, because there's a lot more relationships, a lot more things that you have to manage yourself to coordinate to make sure that everything arrives and it could be the symphony that production goes well. Like, how did you even prepare yourself mentally to shift from something that everything else was taken care of by this person, and now you've taken on all this responsibility?
You don't. You just do it. Like, it's like anything in startups. Like, there is no preparation. It's existential. You there is, the alternative is death. So
gotcha.
you'll do anything, right? And there is no preparation. You're like, oh crap, we need to make X amount of units, and we need to take this in-house. What's step one? Step one is, who's the supplier and what's the contact? Send the contact an email. Like, then they respond back and say, no, actually, we need you to format the PO in this other way. Cool, change the PO. It's just like, like, solve mini problems one after another, after another, after another. And then, you know, you do that for a couple months and you're like, okay, generally, this is my like flow for how I order all the inputs. And then you do that for years to come.
It sounds like taking all of that responsibility in-house was so important to allow you to reach profitability, which is such a great milestone. For founders who are in the middle of that process, where they are trying to figure things out, redefine their logistics, any advice there?
Yeah, I mean, as I said earlier, like, we are in the volume game, and the only way to get to profitability is volume. Just like plain and simple. Unless you're selling, you know, perfume or certain beauty products, or, you know, if your gross margin is 85% right out the gate, even at low volume, yeah, you're probably going to get to profitability pretty quickly. If you're selling pretty much any food or beverage item, you just have to get to extreme volume. And I mean, it's why it's such an incredibly difficult business. Like I said earlier, that like threshold is roughly, call it 30 million units a year. And so what happens when you hit 30 million units a year is, and by the way, it's not just volume. You actually have to do something about it when you get to that volume. So let's say you get to that volume because you have product market fit and you're really good at sales and marketing and all that. Now you have to do a series of things to exploit that volume, meaning you need to go back to every one of your vendors and say, hey, now that I'm buying 10 times more product, I need you to ship in trucks instead of, you know, less LTL, less than a truckload, a couple pallets on a truck that has 500 other items, because that's going to reduce my freight cost, you know, as you know, per bar. And I need you to give me this price break. And then you go back to your manufacturer and you say, hey, now that I'm producing 10 times more product, I need you to reduce my labor as a, you know, my labor cost per bar from X to Y. And, you know, you systematically go through your entire value chain and just twist dials in every single spot. And then magically you wake up the next day and you're like, whoa, okay, like we're profitable. I would say the other thing too is how, you know, obviously the next question is, how do you get that volume? And I would say find channels, and this is different for different people, but find channels that are ultra scalable, that you can grow into tens of millions of units with. Don't add up 10 channels that in aggregate get you to 30 million units. If you can get to 30 million units with one channel, do that. And then the second best option is getting there via two channels, and third best is via three. But like less channels, more volume is really the trick.
Well, that brings the question of the relationships you have with retailers. You have to make sure that people actually want to sign POs with you and they will receive this massive volume that you build. What's your advice there for developing those retailer relationships?
My advice is build a great e-commerce business, which maybe is counterintuitive, right? So order of operation matters a lot. I think a lot of people think, okay, food and beverage product, you know, 93 cents of every dollar is spent in those categories at brick and mortar stores, right? We go to Trader Joe's or whatever. So I guess you go pitch Trader Joe's, right? Actually wrong. The way to get into a retailer, at least the way we found, the best way, the most streamlined way, is build a great e-commerce business, because every retailer today looks at e-commerce, because e-commerce moves faster than retail. It just, the laws of physics, you know, dictate that, right? Digitally, things move faster. You can refresh product display pages much faster than you can refresh a physical store. And so they'll look at, okay, what's doing well online and where am I lagging in my set? My bar set or my yogurt set or my alternative milk set or whatever it is, where do I need to pull in innovation? Because retailers need you just as much as you need them. They need to refresh their sets because they're competing, just like I'm competing against Clif Bar, they're competing against, you know, whatever, Trader Joe's versus Whole Foods versus Walmart versus Target, yada, 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 yada. So they need innovation. And so if you start with e-commerce and build up a great business there, they will literally come to you. Like, they will literally email you or call you. That happened to us with Walmart, for example. And then you got into Walmart. And so had we inverted that order of operations and just knocked on Walmart's door all day long, you're never getting into Walmart. But because you built a great e-commerce business, you know, you flip the script.
Yeah. There's a proof point for your demand, and therefore they can take that and actually bring it into their stores and hopefully expand that demand even more. Yeah, that's really great to hear. And I know that you're also, initially IQ Bar started with the focus on brain, and it's now for body and brain. Talk to us about just kind of the evolution of the thesis of the brand as well.
Yeah. I mean, this is why starting digitally is... it's not just better for the reasons I mentioned on, as it relates to brick and mortar. It's better as it relates to finding product market fit. So, you know, we started with Kickstarter and then we rolled out a Shopify site and we started selling on Shopify. And one of the primary benefits of all of that is we got a ton of feedback very, very quickly via reviews, post-purchase surveys, et cetera. And once you hear 500 people say, hey, this should be sweeter, well, it should probably be sweeter, right? And you tried it in your kitchen and you gave it to your neighbors and they thought it was good, but now 500 people just told you it should be sweeter. So great, make the product sweeter. And then 500 other people told you, hey, this was cool, this brain food concept, but what if it had protein? And so on and so forth. And you get all this feedback. And the answer isn't just to take feedback, even feedback a lot of people gave you, and just do it, right? Every sort of macro feedback vector you get, you need to look at through the lens of, is this on brand and coherent with like the product we want to put out? If we make this change, will it degrade other aspects of the product, right? So an example of that would be like, hey, I want it sweeter. And you're like, cool, I'll add sucralose. And that may sound good because it makes it taste better and sweeter. But now all the people who were buying you because you had a clean label product are pissed off, right? So you helped demographic over here and hurt this other demographic over there. So you always have to look at, like, can we make this tweak? And it, the, like, people it pisses off to people it makes happy ratio is extremely favorable. And sometimes the people it pisses off is, like, almost zero. And that's a slam dunk. And so just keep focusing on there. And the net result of that for us was we migrated from being a brain food product to being a brain and body nutrition product. And it also dictates how, like, what the best way for you to speak to people as, and what you, how you brand your product, and which call outs you highlight, and in which hierarchy you call them out in, and all of that, right? So just like order of operations matters for go-to-market, order of operations in terms of call out hierarchy matters. So me saying, hey, this is a plant protein bar with 1 gram of sugar that, by the way, has these cool brain nutrients. That order of operation, that pitch is infinitely better than, hey, this is a brain bar. Oh, and it has some protein and is low sugar too. Those, it's the same product, but different positioning has radically different outputs in terms of sales.
Yeah, you're kind of trying to speak to the consumer in the way that they want and also give them the information that would make them check the list in their head to be like, okay, this is a product that I actually want to buy.
Yeah, you have to understand how people shop your category, which the same consumer will shop different categories in different ways. So it's the same consumer is not fully logical, right? So if I go to the bar aisle, I'll flip over every bar and look at the back and analyze it really closely. And then I'll go to the chip aisle and I'll just, like, grab tortilla chips. I won't even look at the back. I'm like, yeah, those are chips, whatever.
Yeah.
That's not logical. Why would I care about what's in the bar but not in the chips? So, but it is how people shop, and that's how people shop categories. So don't, like, worry about what's logical. Worry about the playing field as it is. How do people shop your category? And what do they cycle through in terms of value props they're looking for when they're shopping your category? So for bars, that would be protein, protein source, meaning like plant protein versus call it whey protein, sugar, how clean is the label, and how does it taste?
Well, throughout this process of taking feedback and selecting which ones to implement, I think it's also really important and highlights the fact that sometimes you have to say no to certain opportunities, which reminds me of your experience with CVS. Talk to us about the importance of saying no to certain opportunities as well.
Totally. You're going to have quote unquote misadventures in this game, both digital and brick and mortar. I would say brick and mortar is more painful of a misadventure. But yeah, our first retailer was CVS, who, you know, great retailer and whatnot. But it was just not a good fit for a variety of reasons. And it didn't work for a variety of reasons. And we were super naive, right? We saw the prospect of a big purchase order and we thought, heck yeah, let's do that and let's test it. And, because at that time we were like, we want to get to XYZ revenue goal and that'll help us raise money at ABC valuation. And then we'll figure it out thereafter. And so that was just a way to help us to get to that revenue level we needed to get to. And so we had this opportunity to go into, it was a section of the store that was brain boosting functional products or something like that. It was like a brain themed section. And it was like pills, powders, and then our bars. And we went into 3,000 stores and it just flopped. And it flopped for a variety of reasons. I would say the channel, honestly, is the biggest one. Like, if your target consumer isn't walking in the door in the first place, then you're in trouble. If your target consumer is walking in the door, but they can't find you where they would expect to find you, you're in trouble. If they walk in the door and they can find you where they expect to find you, but you've been sitting on the shelf too long because, you know, the velocities of that product are so much lower than some other retailer, you're in trouble. You know, if all of those things are true, but your branding isn't there and your call out hierarchy isn't there, you're in trouble. So it's just, there's so many ways to lose. But honestly, like that first one is probably the biggest one, which is just channel. And so it's just really hard to win in the drug channel. And we learned that very painful lesson and adjusted accordingly. So that's the other thing. Like your products will not work everywhere. They just won't, because oftentimes you will get surprised at where your product works. And for example, it might work really well as an airline snack, and airlines were not on your radar. But it turns out that you can move a mini version of your product and 300,000 units of it every month on Delta flights. And that was never on your radar as a channel, but that's an incredible channel. So it's not to say like just zero in on the obvious channels that you would think would fit. You know, find ways to micro test, ideally every channel, that if you fail, isn't existentially harmful or isn't extremely financially painful. That's the key, that like caveat. And then just like look at the data on where it works and double and triple down there.
Well, it sounds like product and channel fit is very important. And we've talked about expanding the concept of IQBar to look after brain and body. So I guess when you're also evaluating expanding product lines and developing new products, how do you find the right fit, or what kind of framework are you thinking about to evaluate those new product opportunities?
So firstly, don't do that if you don't have to. The best like business model is something like an AG1, where it's just one SKU, you know, it's one product, and I can sell a zillion of these things. That is the holy grail. So if you can do that, do that. If you can't do that, like for example, we can't do that. You can't have a bar company and have one SKU and sell a zillion of it. So it's like, okay, what's the next best thing? The next best thing is have a variety of flavors. Okay, now I have 10 SKUs instead of one, way more complexity, but now I can sell a zillion of across 10 SKUs. And then like the next thing after that is, okay, I'm going to hit some ceiling even with 10 SKUs. And so how do I expand into other categories and platformize myself? And you know, by the way, it's not just how can I sell a zillion, it's in an e-commerce context, how can I build the biggest basket possible? It's forget the macro volume, the micro volume of one consumer going to your site. Are they going to buy 300 bars? No, but they might buy 50 bars and then 50 hydration sticks and then 50 coffee sticks, right? So now I'm optimizing not just on the macro, not just on expanding my ceiling and my total addressable market, but I'm also optimizing on the micro of expanding the average order value. So again, the best is AG1, but most people aren't that. And so act accordingly. So for us, what did that mean? That meant let's move into ancillary categories that are non-cannibalizing and that check off like 50 items. So we have a laundry list that any new category we go into has to adhere to, has to be, you know, at least 1 year shelf life, ideally 2 years, ship friendly, low weight, has to work omni-channel, so e-com and brick and mortar. It has to be coherent with brain and body nutrition, right? So it's, you know, again, a tortilla chip, like not really brain and body nutrition relevant. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so we identified hydration and caffeination as two things we could operate in, spaces that were big, you know, fast growing, and checked all those boxes, incoherent with the brand that we could expand into. But you don't do it because it's easy, right? It's incredibly hard. You're basically starting new startups every time you move into a new category. Because in many cases, you have a new manufacturer. We had to go find a new manufacturer because a bar co-packer is not going to be your powder co-packer. So it's like we're starting at square zero. But am I glad we did it? Yes, I'm glad we did it.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad we covered so many of the company's chapters, from like Kickstarter to production to bringing supply chain in-house to reaching profitability. And it sounds like the product expansion is building new startups. I guess, what are you looking forward to for the next challenge, or what are some things that you're excited about today?
Oh, man. I mean, yeah, it's like different seasons of the company's life. So I think some of the earlier seasons were, quite frankly, just find product market fit, which I think we've found. And then another season was, how do we platformize? Which categories do we layer onto bars? And then another season was, how do we find channel product fit? Like, you know, once we've been in the market selling for whatever, 5 years, we have enough data to where we know which channels can we triple down on. And I would say the season we're in now, and what I look forward to now, is how do we climb the leaderboard and climb the ranks in those channels? Like, how do we just take what we're doing now and do it at hyper speed and do it and be the best in the country at it?
Yeah. Fine-tuning, maybe not the most exciting or sexy, but I think it's very important for growth as well. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Will.
Thank you for having me.
That's Will Nitza, founder and CEO of IQBar. Our show is produced by Gogo Zoger, Megan Coyle, and Alicia Clark. Our engineers are Matt Schwartz and Miku Betlem, and I'm your host, Shuang Esther Shan. We're here every Tuesday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts, plus on YouTube with video episodes. So go check those out, and we'll see you next time. Thank you so much.